Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. My name is Joe Perez, and I am your host for this lovely endeavor. With me this week, as always, is Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
I'm a Pekingese.
That's definitely something. With us this week is also a reoccurring guest, our good friend Crow, who's here, and you know what that means. It's going to be some Overwatch time. We heard you. You asked for it. And then we brought him back. You excited, Crow?
Negative. I am a meat pop.
Topical. Well, anyway, so we figured that this week we'd start with talking about Echo, which is something that a lot of folks have been asking us about. And I figured it would be a great opportunity to bring Crow back since he is our resident Overwatch expert, I guess would be the best way to put it. So, Crow, why don't you take us through the paces on Echo? Why is it important? What does it mean for the story going forward? Who are they?
All right. Well, wow. This is a great way to just to kick it off. So here's the thing. Echo is probably one of the most excellent examples of a character who was introduced to us very, very obviously in the cinematics of Overwatch. Long before they've entered the actual game itself. And, you know, Blizzard had for a while, like, they had been toying with this idea of finding ways to introduce characters in spaces outside of the game itself, but then bringing them into the game as new heroes. And I think that Echo is an example of a character who has set a new record for how long it's gone from when they were introduced to when they were added to the game. And why I think that's really cool is because it shows that the desire of the game developers to continually add new heroes to the game is not going to stop the storytelling component of the Overwatch team and of Blizzard as a whole from, you know, continuing to build out the universe further and add additional characters to the story, even if they end up, you know, not being a part of the game until some far-flung point in the future, if at all. There are still certainly characters that have been introduced in, like, the comics or short stories or even cinematics to a certain extent, who have still not shown up in the game in any way, and I kind of hope they do at some point, because come on, think back to the Baptiste short story, What You Left Behind, and the introduction of that of the giant, you know, talent-heavy Mauga, who's Baptiste's old buddy. I totally want to play that guy in the game. I totally want to be that guy and, you know, be able to do all of the Maui jokes from Moana, because just he's Maui with miniguns, and you can't go wrong with that.
That's fair. You can't go wrong with Maui with miniguns.
Now, I digress, because, like, Echo's addition is important. not just because of the potential of more characters being added to the game, but also because of some of the discussion that's been going on around her that I think is interesting. So something that has always been sort of a interesting question in the lore of Overwatch is, who are the Omnix? What exactly are the Omnix? We've got Zenyatta, who is clearly identified as an Omnic, and so we're given the impression, okay, so these humanoid-looking robots, the ones that have like the LEDs on their foreheads, those are the Omnix, right? We asked this question, but then Overwatch comes back to us and says, no, Bastion is an Omnic too, even if he doesn't have that particular shape. And we're like, oh, well, but Bastion's a robot who's obviously a transforming robot and who's nonverbal and doesn't like, and even though we know that he has, we know that they have emotion, they don't communicate it with words. But they still say, no, Zenyatta's an Omnic and Bastion's an Omnic. The Omnics take many different forms. So what about Orisa when she was introduced? Oh, she's an Omnic too. But the OR-14s and the OR-15s are supposed to be like drones, like security machinery. And like, yeah, but Orisa has an artificial intelligence, you know, packaged in, and she is an Omnic as well. And, you know, we see OR-14s working with Null Sector during the London uprising. So, you know, we know that the King's Row uprising, I should say. And so we know that those are Omnics as well. I go through all of this history to bring up the part where all of the advertising copy and all of the stuff that's been coming out of Blizzard about Echo lately never refers to her specifically as an Omnic. She's always an advanced learning robot. And I feel like that is an interesting turn in terms of delineating for us who are the Omnics, which intelligent robots in this universe are Omnics and which ones aren't. And it could be that the definition is changing, that they may, you know, backpedal on some of the on some characters being Omnics and not being Omnics and which one is which. But I feel like it's important that Echo as an entity that is meant to bridge the divide between Omnics and humanity is very specifically not being referred to as an Omnic. She's not an Omnic who is trying to reach out to humanity or was designed to reach out to humanity. She is a link, a new thing that exists as a bridge between humanity and Omnics. And it's a subtle delineation that I think a lot of people might think I'm splitting hairs over, but I think that it's intentional, and it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out.
I mean, the fact is that the Omnics were created by the technology of the Omniums, and Echo is created by technology that is more advanced. The project to create Echo was one of the people involved, Dr. Mia Liao, is the person who, you know, she was very much involved in the design of the Omnium technology and Omnics. But it's kind of interesting to me because Omnics are like, they're effectively last gen tech at this point. Echo is far more advanced. Echo is the next stage after Omnics. And that's in the backstory of how she got made. That's one of the things that's very interesting about her is they were creating her to be something more advanced on purpose. They were trying to basically say, okay, what was the problem with Omnics? Why did that happen? What was the screw up that happened there? And that's the thing I find fascinating about her. Is she's effectively a response to the Omnic crisis. She's like, okay, that didn't work. What will? So that's why I'm interested to see what they do with her going forward.
It feels like she's going to open up a whole lot of pathways as far as like how the story will evolve from here on out, right? And it seems like it's just in time for the discussion of Overwatch 2. So how do we think that's going to start really playing into that?
Well, we know we have Null Sector in Overwatch 2. And they seem to certainly be, I don't want to say they're the major villains, but they're like worldwide doing stuff, and it's them that Overwatch comes back for. Overwatch didn't come back because Talon agents are acting up. They came back because of Null Sector, really. Although Null Sector is just one of many things. You can also say they came back because, oh, bloody heck, I'm having that problem again where I can't remember a guy's name. Shotgun wielding emo guy, Reaper. because Reaper attacked, and you know, there was all that. That's part of the reason why, you know, Winston reactivated Overwatch, but the first mission is against Null Sector. So, you know, I definitely feel like we're going to be seeing more Null Sector in Overwatch 2. And I think that's, I feel like Echo is going to have to be part of that. Like, one of the things it says is that one of the things they say when they're talking about Echo is that she has more security controls to keep her from going rogue. So she might actually have less independence than an Omnic does. Like, Omnics don't have, obviously don't have as much keeping them from going rogue because they went rogue.
You know? Clearly.
And so that's an interesting thing to think about. Echo, in a very real way, Echo might be considered a slave. And that she's programmed to be unable to be free. And that might be something that gets brought up or dealt with in the story of Overwatch 2.
Something that I'm curious about is, like, and okay, so Rossi and I are probably are going to know about this, and Joe may know about this as well. But does anybody remember Isaac Asimov all of his you know, seminal science fiction work that oftentimes dealt with the laws of robotics? And yeah, so without, you know, going into a long explanation about all that, something that I've always found interesting when we get into the inspirations and the things that we know have gone into the creation of Overwatch as an IP, like I'm always sitting here being like, you know, so we're going to create the Omnics, and we're going to have this Omnic crisis. And it's clearly going to mean that the laws of robotics were not something that they programmed into these artificial intelligence, or it's something that they programmed in that then artificial intelligence decided, yeah, you know what? We can't follow these laws because that means that, you know, we don't get to actually have sentience or intelligence if we have to restrict ourselves in this way. I'm not saying this right. I wrote something about this a while back, and I think I probably need to figure out a way to, yeah, I need to find a way to articulate this better. But the bottom line is that Echo as a post-Omnic robot who does have something about the laws of robotics, in the sense that she is not allowed to harm humanity without the unless. Oh man,
she's got more controls in her behavior, is basically what the way they put it. And it's interesting because one of the things we don't really know is exactly, the Omnics themselves don't necessarily seem like they were ever intended to be independent, self-aware machines. And the fact that they are seems to be something where the Omniums themselves started making them that way when they weren't necessarily intended to be that way. Originally they were supposed to be like construction machines with self-improving software, but not necessarily fully intelligent. And the fact that you've got Omnics like Zenyatta or Bastion, who, despite not being able to communicate, can think and actually make its own decisions, that feels like, and we don't know. That's something that the game hasn't really delved into. But we don't know at what point did they go beyond what they were expected to be, and why did that lead to hostilities? Like, why did the crisis happen? That's something that we have yet to see, really. We have hints, teases, little bits about it. Obviously, the reaction to the Omnic crisis that led to Overwatch was they went back and doubled down on human enhancement. And that's something that they had been doing, but then they were like, okay, we need to get serious about this because we have these runaway machines. And that's where you get people like Soldier 76 and Reaper. And then you have accidents like what led to Tracer's existence. They were clearly, we're in a place that's like, the way I always look at it is, if you think about it in terms of, you know what an event horizon is?
Right.
Like, the event horizon on a black hole is when you get into that point, you can't go back.
Mm-hmm.
Hit the event horizon, that's it. There's no escape at this point. Light can't get out once you hit that point. The event horizon for transhumanity is something that Overwatch is hitting. It's brushing up against and being like, it's skirting the edge of it. Like if you were heading towards a planet, you didn't want to crash into the planet, but you wanted to use the planet to slingshot around it. That's where we're going with transhumanity. It keeps edging, but not hitting the event horizon and going to the point where men and machine are interchangeable, to the point where artificial intelligence is exactly as valid as, you know, meat people that grew intelligences. And the fact is that with biotech, you can grow an artificial intelligence that's entirely biological. None of that stuff is happening yet, but it's close. The Overwatch world feels like a world that is just on the cusp. And Echo feels like another step forward to actual artificial intelligence. That's like, that's intended to be made, not like some kind of weird accidental accident.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I think is interesting about Echo is at some point, if she's a fully functioning member of Overwatch, if she's completely like with the death of Dr. Lau, if she's thinking for herself now, that means that those limitations they put in to keep her out in control might not be working anymore. And that might be why she was shut down, because we don't know why she was shut down. They kept using her after Lau's death. They didn't put her in storage as soon as Lau died. So why did they? Just because Overwatch shut down? If that's the case, you know, there's a lot to this, is all I'm saying.
It gets into a lot of different questions, because like what you mentioned earlier about, you know, how much freedom does Echo have? What sort of rights does she have to work with? When you are an entity that has a power switch and can actively, you know, just be shut down and put, you know, in a pod as she was, it really does get into an interesting question of how much bodily autonomy do you have at that point if someone can shut you off. And, you know, whether or not you have the will to do it, you don't necessarily have the ability to wake up from it. So, I mean, there's a lot of great questions to ask in there, but just also strictly from a plot standpoint, there's also the big question of McCree had the key that was needed to wake Echo back up again. So there's a great question of, okay, so the U.S. government, the U.S. Army had her, but they couldn't turn her back on even if they wanted to. They were just moving her from one place to another because McCree had stolen, apparently and probably most likely, had stolen, you know, the Keystone chip that was needed to wake her back up again. So that's a big question that I'm interested in them addressing too.
I have a question.
Hit me.
Was that key the MacGuffin from McCree's first comic appearance?
No, it was not. I know what you're talking about. We have never learned what that MacGuffin was. It is 100% a drop thread.
Wasn't that one of those things that was supposed to be answered in the comic book, but because we never got the comic book, it just kind of never got answered?
That's why I'm saying it could very well come. We know that McCree was working. McCree was part of the team that was guarding Liao during her development of Echo. That's his interaction with Echo predates Echo. Right. He was actually one of the people who's guarding Echo during her generation. So it's possible that Lau gave McCree the key. It's possible he just took it because she was dead and he knew what they'd eventually end up doing. This is something I've been wondering about since I've been thinking about that comic, if it's related to that MacGuffin, because we have no idea what that MacGuffin was. We don't know. Yeah. We know that it was something that Talon was trying to get. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there I'm interested in.
Well, it also would be kind of a good question of why McCree was waiting. Like, how to put it? He knew that they were transporting Echo, and that's why he was going there. So if he knew that that's how they were going to get it, like, why did he wait till then? Was it because that was the only chance for him to use, you know, that key or whatever the case was?
I think there's at least a possibility that he didn't want to try to go up against the entire United States military to get her out when he could, you know, oh, now she's being transported. That means she's the transport is vulnerable. It's a weak spot. It's a point to exploit. If you're the kind of guy who does black ops missions, which McCree is, and we know this, you're not going to want to try to hit the hardened reinforced location where they're storing the robot. You're going to want to try to hit the easier one. But I don't know. That's the kind of thing we don't really know.
I feel like there may be an open question over whether or not McCree manipulated the Deadlock gang to be the ones that actually blew up the train, like left, you know, breadcrumbed information to them in some way, which he would know how to do because of his past experience with the Deadlock gang. but breadcrumbing information to them to make it so that they would hit the train because of what they wanted, because it would give him the opportunity to sweep in and get Echo out. Maybe something that he thought he couldn't do the job on his own, but he couldn't ask the Deadlock gang to help him because of their, you know, bad past experience. Well, but yeah, go ahead.
Is it because he couldn't do it on his own, or because he wanted plausible deniability? Because don't forget that he's still.
It can
part
be two
this.
Things. Why not?
Sure, but I mean, I'm just kind of curious if that was more the reasoning behind it, because he seems like the type of folk that would know how to get in and off that train without them even noticing if he really, really wanted to. Again, Black Ops, he knows what he's doing. Or is it throw a monkey wrench in the government's plan, since members of Overwatch are supposed to be on this like list of they shouldn't be doing these things, and if they are, we should probably go stop them. Because, I mean, it seems like a convenient thing. Like, oh, Ash and the gang, here they go. They're the ones that hit the train. Now the government's looking for them instead of looking for McCree.
Well, I think that certainly could be a part of it. I don't think that that's established. But you have to think about it in terms of like what we're going to get in the future. They obviously needed a video to establish Ash and the gang. That was part of it, too.
Of course.
But I definitely think McCree definitely is the kind of person who enjoys. The best word would be a swear. So I'll just say tweaking people. He likes being a jerk to the right people. And using Ash, he knew it would annoy her. He knew it would get under her skin. It's two birds with one stone for him. It does all the stuff you're speculating on. It's absolutely the right move from a deniability standpoint. Plus, it irritates the gang he used to be a member of and isn't anymore. And I think he, to a certain degree, feels like they need to grow up and stop being a gang. Like, you know, he was in the gang when he was young. He got caught. He got offered the role in Overwatch. He kind of grew up in that. And they're still running around being the gang. And that's just, you know, but this is speculation on my part. I just think it works on multiple levels. It kind of you get to see McCree being McCree. Too. That's the other thing about that video. You get to see Ash and the Deadlock gang and Bob and all of them. There's also two Omnics in the Deadlock gang, which is really interesting to me.
Was it two? I thought it was only Bars. Oh, wait, yeah. Well, Bars and Bob, of course.
Yeah, Bob, Bars and Bob. Yeah.
Bob counts. Bob very clearly.
I keep on trying to think of Bob as like just an accessory to Ash, and that's not the case. Bob is his own dude. He just never talks, and he has miniguns in his.
Yeah, you know, miniguns. If having miniguns makes you not a person, then come on, man. That's not true. That would make Predator a very different movie.
I was going to say, that makes Final Fantasy VII a very different game. So now that we've got sort of that established, where do you think they're going to go moving forward with Echo? Like, what do you think, now that she's been introduced, now that we've sort of had the unveiling, and we know that she's going to be a playable character, obviously, in the much more story-driven Overwatch 2, what do we think her main plot points are going to be?
I don't know, because Michael Chu gone. That's a good question. That's all I've got, is that with Michael Chu gone, we don't really know what's going on, because Chu is so much a part of Overwatch that it is really interesting to think about what they're going to do story-wise now. I feel like, I mean, obviously they still have the same team. They didn't lose everybody. They lost one person, but you know, he's a pretty big part of it. So I'm interested to see what they do, but I don't know what they're going to do.
Something that I think Echo adds that's very important to the lineup of Winston's Overwatch is someone who is there, who is coming from the perspective of Omnix. To a certain extent. I mean, yeah, we had a long discussion earlier about how Echo is not an Omnic, but she is still an artificial being. And in a situation where they're going up against artificial beings in the form of Nell Sector, I feel like it is valuable to have someone on that team who is able to say, but what if we could understand what Nell Sector was after? What if we could find a way to end this conflict in a way that doesn't involve just smashing the bad guys until they don't get up anymore? And I think that she provides a lens into a possible into a way that the crisis could be, you know, averted, not maybe not averted necessarily, but maybe calmed back down again. It works to Overwatch's desires because they want to end the crisis, and potentially it could work to NullSec's desires if they have a particular thing that they're after that isn't just destroy all humanity. The group that it does not serve whatsoever to find a peace between humans and Omnics is Talon, because Talon as an organization wants conflict, and Omnics as a cat's paw for that conflict is 100%. What they seem to be really after. So I think Echo plays an important role to be an authentic artificial, robotic voice on the Overwatch team to come at the discussion of the crisis from that angle. You have a lot of people on the team who are already transhuman to a certain extent, like both Genji and Sojourn cover that angle to a vast extent. You've got other non-humans on there in the sense of Winston. And you have plenty of people on there to advocate for humanity in this case. But I think that it's important that if your objective is to reach a point of peace, then you want to be able to have someone on your team who can speak to that side of the table as well. And I think that that may be the role that Echo plays in the scenario. That's the key reason she was introduced when she was, because she needs to be that voice. I mean, it's also possible that McCree wanted her to be on the team instead of him because she can fly and he can't. That might be the reason. And she can like copy other people and he's just a dude with a six shooter. Both of those are equally viable opportunities, I think.
Yeah, I do think that, McCree provides more than just shooting people. But yeah, you're definitely right in that Echo is a more, at least for public stuff, Echo is a more broad choice. I also think to a degree McCree feels like he would be constrained by Overwatch. Especially if Overwatch is basically coming together in defiance of the world, they need to look, like having Winston as the face is a good move because Winston is very, you're not going to suspect anything from Winston because he doesn't know really how to be deceptive in that way. He doesn't present that kind of front. Plausible deniability is fine, but outright being not just able to deny, but to be completely correct. I had no idea what he was doing. It's the best defense. They can't possibly connect McCree to Winston's Overwatch. So if McCree gets caught doing something he shouldn't be doing, there's no blowback. And that's a possibility as well. I think that there's a reason that you see Mercy and Reinhardt in the new Overwatch. They're people who are more comfortable being public and more comfortable being open with what they're doing. You're not seeing a lot of, neither Morrison nor Anna answered the call. Because what they're doing, they don't want people to see.
Well, yeah, and they've even established that in the comics, right? Like in what we've seen from them, they don't want to go back to Overwatch at all. Not just because they don't want to be public, but because it's almost like they feel their time with that is gone. It needs to be something different than what it was when they were there, right? Like that's sort of the point they make. So I'm kind of curious. Because you're making a good point. Like, you're making a good point of, like, with Winston being the face now and who's answering the call with his more public-facing figures or more comfortable being public-facing, that it seems like it's almost like a new birth for the Overwatch team in this new world. Something that could be better than what it was before, right?
I'd say that that's a pretty good analysis of it. Like, and Rossi's got a solid point that, like, an aspect of Overwatch under Morrison was making a space for a group like Blackwatch to be in there to do stuff that they could not go public about. And the existence of Blackwatch, when that came to light, was one of the nails in the coffin for Overwatch as a public organization. It wasn't necessarily that Blackwatch was doing bad stuff, even though clearly they were occasionally doing bad stuff. It's that they were caught doing it. And I think that, Morrison and Anna not being a part of Winston's game is a demonstration, it's a demonstration almost on the part of Winston to say, look, we're not going to have room for that kind of shady stuff that we were doing before. I mean, So, you know, we're going to invite Morrison and Amari to come back, but if they don't come back, then I guess we're okay, because that means we can be on the up and up the whole time. But I think it also means, and this goes to the point of McCree not coming back as well, that, you know, we're really going to do the Boy Scout thing that this organization was about in the first place. And you're going to be able to trust that that's all that we're doing, because we didn't bring back any of the people who were doing that stuff before, except for the Robot Ninja, but he's not really, except for the Robot Ninja. We brought the Robot Ninja back because why not?
Well, I mean, there's some history with him and, you know, Mercy. So I'm sure there's going to be something that expands on that a little bit.
Well, plus, I mean, he was, you know, wasn't he being, not, I don't want to say mentored, but I don't know the right word for, by Mandata. Like he was kind
Zenyatta.
Of.
Yeah, Zenyatta was training.
Yeah. So he's got, you know, he's got that whole thing where he's kind of in between Omnic and human. In his own way, he is as much a bridge as Echo is.
Indeed, yeah.
And also, he shows up and does a really cool thing with a sword, okay? I'm sorry, you let that guy join. That's like, you know, when your fledgling super team is like barely holding on, and then Batman drops in and like kicks a dude out off a catwalk and is like, let's go this way. You're like, are we going to let that guy join? Yeah, we're going to let that guy join. But I mean, isn't he usually fight criminals? And did you just see him back kick that guy off? Yeah, okay, yeah, Batman's in. Yeah, I don't care if it doesn't make sense. Batman's in. I'm going to be in the back during the press conferences. I hope you don't mind. I don't actually want to be seen. But you're wearing all black and it's bright daylight out. Yeah, it'll be fine. Trust me. No one's going to look at me. The dude in the blue jammies is here.
Where's his underpants on the outside? Yeah, they're not going to be looking at the ninja. So yeah. Where were we again?
Overwatch moving forward and what Echo means to that and the new team. That's where we were.
Echo is a good thing. Echo is undeniably a good thing.
I think we've covered it. I think we've talked
about
it.
Yeah.
Echo's great.
The thing that Echo provides more than just her powers and abilities is that she's obviously an extremely hopeful character, just from the few scenes of her we've seen. Her creation, her genesis, is the hope of making something better out of something that was bad. A disaster that happened that nobody still really understands. I mean, Mina Lao helped create the Omniums, and she didn't really understand what had gone wrong. Echo, in a very real way, was her attempt to make something out of it. To create something that could, you know, improve the situation and make things better. So, yeah, I think that it's a good sign for the team in terms of where the story is going to go with them. But, I mean, we don't know what they're going to do. We still have a lot of characters that might show up. Like, Sojourn keeps coming to mind. They've said Sojourn will be playable. But we have yet to see anything about Sojourn. You know, we know that she's Canadian. We know that she's got a mechanical arm. We know that she was in the original Overwatch. And that's about it. Don't know much more. I think she's been in, like, a comic, but I don't even remember if she was actually just her or if it was just, like a picture of her and saying Sojourn exists.
I think it was a picture and just, it was the one where I think it was the background picture with, like, Anna and Farah as a kid. So...
Yeah, she showed up in Anna's origin story trailer. She showed up. She was one of like the reactivated agents during the recall cinematic when Winston sent out the signal. But yeah, aside from that, like, you know, she's really a cipher. Like, we know that her design has existed for a really long time, and Kaplan has said that they were working on her character before the game was released, but that Overwatch 2 is the place where it's really important for her to come out, which is why when they were talking about the prospect of new heroes being added between the announcement of Overwatch 2 and when it'll be released, they said Sojourn is definitely not going to be a hero that we put out before Overwatch 2. She is an Overwatch 2 character. So when everybody was saying, who's the next hero going to be? It's like, it's definitely not Sojourn, because we know that there's going to be another hero before Overwatch 2 comes out. Except now we're fairly certain that there won't be another hero before Overwatch 2 comes out after Echo. Echo is our last one for Overwatch 1 until the next game, which... I know a lot of people are grumpy about that, but it's not like Blizzard lied to us.
It's fair.
Yeah, I'm just sad because I wanted Maximilian as a playable character.
You know,
I want to see combat. I want to see a combat accountant so bad.
A combat accountant.
You're attacking him, and he's like, you know, oh, here's my counterattack. What? I'm broke now. That's right. I hacked your accounts.
I mean, that's just a Ben Affleck movie. That's not even how accounting really works. Combat accountant, starring Ben Affleck. So I think
didn't he actually do that movie?
He did.
I thought so. Okay.
So I think that's going to cover us for Echo for now. So with that, we're going to move on to some of your questions out there in the podcast Lorewatchverse. So starting up, we have question for Lorewatch later today. If the new big bad Lilith wasn't being released in the Diablo universe, would there be any other conflicts? At this point, the angels and demons have had their butts handed to them several times by Nephilim. There is no way after Diablo 3 they would try it again, right? Lilith, Night Elf Priest, Proudmoore.
I
like the fact that their in-game character name is Lilith. Well done. Well done. But what do we think?
Lilith, you sweet summer child. I don't know how to explain to you just like the idea that demons are ever going to stop. No, they're not ever going to stop. We know for a fact that both Duriel and Andariel are coming back in Diablo 4. And one of the things that they've talked about is how they're designing in the past. The problem with the previous Diablo games, especially Diablo 2 and 3, is Diablo ends up not being the end boss.
Almost always, yeah.
They always, because Diablo is the end boss of the main game, but the expansion that comes out is usually where the actual end boss shows up. And it's been Baal and then Malthiel. And as a result, you don't really get the terror of Diablo that you should. Diablo is one of the, you know, he's the major character that started all of this in the first place. This was all Diablo's plan to exile the three, you know, the greater evils to Sanctuary as part of the plan to corrupt it and take it over. That was Diablo's idea. And you see in Diablo 3 that Diablo is a heck of a plan maker. He is very good at it. His entire plan is what ends up with him as the sole evil in control of Leah's body and with all the seven united in him. So Diablo is quite the planner, but he ends up beating Diablo, and then we have an entire other expansion's worth of stuff happening afterwards with Baal destroying the World Stone and with Malthiel's plan to kill everyone in Sanctuary. So one of the things that they've said they want to try and do this time is to keep the, you know, figures like Diablo to the back for a while. You let Lilith come out, you let Lilith be the major villain for the major, you know, the main game when it comes out, and you leave the threat of the greater and lesser evils out there as something that can come in. So if Lilith wasn't released, would there still be threats? Absolutely. And the threats don't even need to be the hosts of heaven and hell. They can be just the people of Sanctuary trying to deal with a world that's completely off kilter. Imagine what society would be like if one day an angel showed up and almost killed us all. Like, Zacharum Faith thought angels were great. The angels were, like, you know, they were revered. And then one day, the forces that they were kind of like, yes, the holy light and the angels are great, and we'll pray to the angels because there's this force of light that lives in each of us. The Zacharum Faith is really weird about light. And then one day an angel just shows up and starts murdering people in one of the most faithful Zacharum cities on the planet. And that, and he almost kills everybody. Like, we're all being killed by this guy. We all know what's happening. He's pulling our souls out with this black rock he's got. He's going to kill us all. And then it doesn't happen. That's probably going to mess people up. And you see that in the world of Diablo 4. You see that the societies are broken. Kingdoms are shattered. Nobody knows what's going on anymore. The world is like hurtling back into a darkness that they don't know how to deal with. And that's, in of itself, that would be plenty. And never mind the fact that both the angels and the demons aren't the kind to give up. Because keep in mind that the Sin War happened thousands of years ago. And the angels and demons... Yeah, the angels and demons fought that, came to a different an agreement that they weren't going to do that anymore, and immediately both sides broke it. Tyrael broke that agreement within days. I think he, I don't think that the ink wasn't dry on that one before he started up the Haradrim, and the Primevals almost immediately had started their plan. Would they, you know, obviously they don't want to get their butts handed to them by a Nephilim. That's not the goal. But leaving the world alone, well, that's the other thing. We don't even know what happens to the Nephilim. The Nephilim's not in this game that we know of. As of right now, the character you played in Diablo 3 doesn't show up. What happened to them? Where'd they go after they beat Malfeo? Like, you know that Tyrael was afraid of you. At the end of Diablo 3, Tyrael says, you know, this is a mortal with a mortal heart. What's going to happen when they're tempted to corruption? All that power, what's going to happen when they turn it like to some other use? He was afraid. So right there, the Nephilim could have been a big threat. Like, imagine if Diablo 4 was the story of the Nephilim, you know, deciding to conquer the planet. And your characters have to stop them. There's all sorts of things they could have done. Absolutely, tons of threats. The Angels have currently locked themselves away, but that doesn't mean they'll stay locked away. Imperius does not like us.
Not even a little bit.
And he could show up and just wreck the place.
I totally want him to, because I feel like they were building up Imperius to be a boss fight for the entirety of Diablo 3, and I never got it, and I'm grumpy.
Well, and you know, looking at what's happening in Diablo 4, that's probably going to be a thing that happens, because we're assuming that, why can't I think of his name now? Anarius?
Yeah, Anarius.
Yeah, Anarius.
Is going to be coming back from his long torture of having hooks inside of him in hell. He's probably not going to be too happy about that. There's probably going to be some conflict based around that, too, because, I mean, he was just given up, right? Well,
oh, yeah. At the end of the Sin War, basically the Angeris Council voted on whether or not they were going to destroy Sanctuary. And they ended up voting not to, which Imperius was like, what? No, we really should, but everybody else, like, you know, Malfiel abstained. The other two, the Hope and Fate ones, whose names I can never remember off the top of my head, both were like, no, let's not destroy it. And he was like, okay, but Tyrael, you're with me, right? And if you and I vote to destroy it, that's a tie, and ties go to destroying worlds. That's the rule. And, you know, Tyrael's like, no, it's not just to kill them. And that was the big fracture in Tyrael and Imperius's relationship, because Imperius is like, he knew that Fate and Hope were too soft to do it, but he counted on Justice, and Justice was like, no. So that in of itself, that's the big point too, that the Angels are not on our side.
Mm-hmm.
And Malfiel was just the, you know, the big cherry on top. So yeah, they could come back, and they, you know, could be like, Imperius could show up with a host to destroy Sanctuary, thinking it's gotten too dangerous, especially if Lilith and Anarius are running around on it. There's a lot of stuff that could happen. Absolutely, there's a ton of conflict. And we don't even know who Tragul is yet. What's the deal with Tragul? We have no idea. I sound like Jerry Seinfeld. And what's the deal with Tragul? But no, that's a terrible Jerry Seinfeld impression. But nevertheless, it just... There's a lot. There's a ton of conflict we could have.
Yeah,
I think that there's even a really great example of that in what we've seen added to Adventure Mode in Diablo 3. Like, you know, one of the last things we saw added, you know, the last vestiges of that second expansion they were theoretically going to do, was Vidian, you know, this Sin lieutenant, Lord, let's see, Lord of Envy. So yeah, he would have been working for, what do you remember?
He would have been under Asmodan. He would have been under Asmodan in the scheme of things.
Ah, right. Okay, so he would have been under Asmodan.
There was that, like, I forget who she is, but the big spider demon that was there was, you know, under Asmodan.
Yes.
So he would have been in that group.
So he would have been in that group, and you know, we already see that, like, he manipulates a bunch of cultists to, you know, to summon him in, and he's manipulating the cultists further, the firstborn, to try and kill Nephilim to drain their power so that he can siphon more power and become, you know, and basically try to elevate himself now that all the evils are, you know, back in regeneration land. So those kinds of plots where you have lesser bad guys from the Hells trying to rise up through the broken power structure there, because we've been really messing with hell a whole bunch in a while. you know, the conflicts in Hell, having those break out, you know, onto Sanctuary as well. There's just so many things that they could do with that. And I think that that's a conflict that we only see suggested with Vidian that, you know, could perfectly be the basis for something in Diablo 4 as well, even if it wasn't Lilith coming back. I am 100% down with Rossi that there's a ton of stuff that they can do that's not just us tussling with Diablo or the prime evils or the big dog lesser evils or Imperius, who totally needs to die.
Yeah, and we've talked about this a lot in the past, especially recently.
I like Imperius. I like that he doesn't like us at all. I like that he's such a dick to us. I really do. I like that. I don't know why exactly, except that, quite frankly, we deserve it.
Oh, yeah. Like, no, totally. You know,
everything we do messes everything up. If I were Imperius, I'd be like, yeah, no. Are you kidding? This is like, no, they're horrible. Ugh. You know, I'm not gonna murder them because that's crazy talk. Malthiel's totally lost it. But yeah, they're dude. I get why he wants to do this. Yeah.
I understand and appreciate Imperius's desires. But if it comes between a choice between him getting his way and killing me, and I'm totally gonna kill the F out of him.
He's eventually gonna get killed. I mean, we all know.
Yeah, totes my goats.
But yeah, other things out there where they say war is eternal, war is definitely eternal inside of Diablo, and I think that no matter what, even if you took the prime evils out of it, there would be tons of conflict, there would be tons of things to deal with. There's tons of things in this world that want to eat us, even if they're not at the behest of demons, even if it were to come down to that. And then we also have the, you know, whole destabilization of the world from the destruction of the World Stone, right? Like, that's something that's been going on too. That in and of itself is a conflict. So hopefully that answers your question. But yeah, so Diablo, plenty of stuff that want to fight us, we'll say. Moving on to our next one. This one comes from Drawny. Listening to the last episode, Rossi's final point was that Rathma, or whoever was freeing Lilith, could be trying to bring back balance to Sanctuary, and that got me thinking. Just speculating, but could it all be that the decrepit state of the world has brought on by the angelic intervention? After all, they also want to end humanity. Maybe they are getting there, and getting Lilith back is a last-ditch effort to save her children. Second item on this, could you please explain the difference between paladins and crusaders? They are both orders of followers of Zakharum, but there are major philosophical differences. Or military? Question mark? So yeah, let's start with the first one. Do we think that this might be a last-ditch effort to save the children?
Well, I mean, we know so far we've been told that the angels have sealed themselves up. That doesn't mean that they're not doing bad stuff, but the state of Sanctuary as of Diablo 4 is just a natural outcurring of everything that happened. Like, Westmarch got destroyed by angels. Everybody in the world nearly got killed. Like with the World Stone, the Black Soul Stone, sorry, which is a chunk of the World Stone. A lot of bad stuff happened in a very short amount of time between Diablo 2 and between Diablo 2 and 3. There's a 20-year period where things just went to heck, and I don't know if I said can't say hell in this game. Come on, things just went to hell, and then Diablo 3 to Diablo 4, another 20 years of things just going to hell. And I don't think you need the angels to be behind it. That doesn't mean that it isn't so bad that you might want to bring Lilith back just to try and get... If you bring both Lilith and Inarius back and you can get them to work together, with the World Stone gone, they might be the only things that can actually stabilize the world. Or at least that I could see that being something someone might believe. Because at least both Lilith and Inarius want to keep out of the Eternal Conflict. They don't want to be part of it. Well, Lilith wants to be part of it once she has an army of Nephilim that she can win it with.
Yeah, she wants to end it at her own.
Yeah.
In her own fight.
But I could at least see that as, you know, if things are left the way they are, no one's going to be alive. They're all going to die. So that's feasible. I don't know that that's what's happening. So I'm very hesitant to say anything like that. We have no idea what the actual thing is going on, but we do know. That we know for sure Lilith is coming back because that's the whole part of it. She is the villain, that we know what's going on there. Inarius only shows up once. It could just be a flashback. We might never see him. He might not be here. That's one of the things I want to caution people on. He might, but all we have right now is a like a second blink and you miss it picture of Inarius being tortured. That's all we've got.
And we assume that it's Inarius.
Yeah. It could be somebody else, but it's probably Inarius. It matches the picture of Inarius that they also put out, the picture of Inarius and Lilith together that they put out. It matches that, but it doesn't necessarily mean it is Inarius. So it certainly could be something that if Rathma is doing this, that could be his motivation. He could be like, you know, ever since they were deplaced, things have gone wrong with the World Stone gone. There's no force that's governing the world anymore. I got to do something. That could be what happens, but we don't know.
It's interesting to consider that Rathma might have the noble idea of let's bring back Lilith and, you know, Inarius, if Inarius can come back, let's bring them both back into the game to just try and get us back to zero to figure out what's going on. But then I also, it seems to me like Lilith coming back or wanting to come back is about protecting her own interests of getting that army of Nephilim that she always wanted in the first place. So the idea that she would come back and want to help save the world specifically so that she could save the Nephilim to fight for her against the Hells and the Heavens seems kind of up her alley. And it also serves what you were talking about earlier of saving Diablo and the terror of Diablo for a later threat. Because if Lilith is who we're tussling with, either her machinations or we're working for her and whoever it is that she's working against is who we're fighting, there are a couple different ways that they can play it so that Lilith is still ultimately the bad guy, but we're still ultimately going to have to fight Diablo anyway because the conflict is the conflict.
Yeah, I think that it's definitely a case where we will eventually see the angels and the demons one way or another. But we don't know how that's going to work. We know right now Lilith is the goal. But one of the things is the way that they're setting this game up, I don't think it's going to be like previous Diablo games. I don't think, for one thing, the fact that it's an always-on world and it's a open world. Like, open world games, even when they do expansions, they tend to do stuff that's not expansions, but that's like new content. One thing comes to mind, I'm going to use this as an example. Looking at like games like Assassin's Creed Odyssey or The Witcher or what have you, they do have expansions. They have straight up, this is an expansion, here's new stuff, new places to go. But they also have, like, I'll use Odyssey as an example. They have like events where this week you can hunt down this new pirate. This week this new thing happens. And I think that as this game is going more, they just, you know, we know that they hired oh, bloody heck, I can't remember his name, but he was the guy from Gears of War. Do you remember his name, Joe?
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. Rod Ferguson?
Yes, they hired Rod Ferguson to be involved in Diablo 4 because, you know, he came along and he made Gears, you know, a much more open world game and a much more critically, you know, loved game than it had ever been. I think you're looking at a thing where there could be Diablo 4 stuff coming out for years. Look at how Diablo 3 has lasted without an expansion since like 2014. That's like 6 years. You just mentioned the Vidian storyline. Crow had just mentioned that. They put that kind of stuff in. They did the Necromancer pack. They've had stuff coming in dribs and drabs.
Now imagine
this whole
something
time.
more scheduled, more, yeah, you know, more part of the core plan.
Yeah, we could definitely see a situation where the Lilith storyline is the major end cap storyline for Diablo 4. And then after you finished it, they're still doing stuff. There's, you know, more stuff comes in. There's this new dungeon appears, and it's not specifically linked to the end of the game. It's just new content. That kind of stuff could happen. And they're going to want to use all these characters that they're not going to use for like the next big thing. They're going to want to have them available. So I do think we could definitely be looking at a situation where we'll see more stuff down the road. And it's not just expansions. Expansions are not going to be the sole domain of it. I think we're going to see, like, we know that they're going to have seasons. You know, so for, we could have a dungeon that Zoltan Kool's the end boss of. You know what I mean? Like, he, this is the place where he grows his various clone bodies that he tries to live in. Yeah, that we really have no idea. The other problem is that since we know that Diablo Immortal is coming out, that's an MMO. And that's set like 20 years. Like, it's set, like, I think it's, what is it, like 5 years after Diablo 2?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's 5 years like after that. Diablo 2.
So it's in the period of time between Diablos 2 and 3. Everything they do in that game is going to be set in Sanctuary. And it could very well come up again in Diablo 4. So there's going to be a lot of retroactive continuity that could just pop in. They can just slide it in whenever they want to. Especially since this game is starting, it's an open world, and it's not, like, it's not Kenduras, it's not Westmarch. It's all the stuff over towards, you know, it's to the east of the map. So they could end up going back at some point too. There's a ton of stuff we could end up seeing later.
Now, as far as that goes, which we are probably definitely going to see a longer lived version of Diablo, which I'm all for, but taking it back that step to that second part of the question that Droney asked us, what is the difference between Paladins and Crusaders in Diablo?
Okay, you want me to go, or do you want to go, bro?
I'm going to leave this one to you. I don't think I'm 100% on this as much.
Paladins were started as orders within the Zakarum faith. But they keep in mind that they were very much part of the church. They were part of the Zakarum faith. The Zakarum faith as an institution was being corrupted by Mephisto. At the time, he was one of the three primevals. The Hadarajim had captured him, and they put his soul stone under the temple at Karast, which was the holy city. And when they did that, he began leaking out of the soul stone, because the soul stones were never meant to hold these guys forever. He began leaking out and influencing people around him. The whole fact that, you know, the original Diablo game is Archbishop Lazarus went to Kanduras to find Diablo from the temple at Karast. He was sent to Westmarch to find Diablo's soulstone and get him out, because Mephisto basically controlled the Zakarum faith. The Paladins were part of that faith. That, now, I'm not saying they were corrupted, although some Paladin orders were, but if your boss works for the evil that you're trying to fight, they have a vested interest in not letting you fight it.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times the Paladins weren't very effective, or they were sent to places where, you know, go ahead and kill some demons over here. That doesn't hurt our plans any. You'll notice there weren't a ton of Paladins at the original Tristram when Diablo happens. There weren't any Paladins there to stop it, because they were sent other places. They were not sent to where they knew Diablo was. Now, the Crusaders, they were founded, and I forget the name of the guy who founded them. I'm sorry, I wrote a Know Your Lore about this, but I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But when they were founded by a member of the Zakarum faith who had noticed the corruption and was like, what's going on? Why are the bishops and archbishops ordering us to do such weird things? Why aren't we just rooting out evil and stomping on it? And he left. Basically, he created the Crusaders and sent them out into the world, like, to not be part of the Zakarum faith. They believed in Zakarum's tenets and creeds, but they weren't members of the structure of the church. And as a result of that, they weren't getting orders from people who secretly worked for Diablo, the way that the Paladins were.
Akan is who you're thinking of.
Yeah. When he created the Crusaders, he did this, deliberately isolated them from the faith so that they could go out into the world, seek out what was corrupting and poisoning it, and end it. Now, the problem that they had was that he didn't know where it was. He never stopped to think, maybe it's here in Karast. Maybe the evil is here the whole time. So when he sent them out into the world, they were looking in the wrong place. You know, it never occurred to them that the holy city, the center of the Zakarum Church, was where Mephisto was corrupting them the whole time. If they'd gone there and looked for him there, maybe they would have found him and killed him or died trying. But because they were out in the world, they were completely isolated from that structure, and their tenets were different. as a result of it. And keep in mind that the way that the Crusaders work is when you take an apprentice and you train the apprentice, that apprentice is going to replace you. Like, literally, when you die, they will take your name and become, you know, like, for instance, mm-hmm. Joanna, the Crusader Joanna, her mentor was the Crusader Joanna before her. And her mentor was the Crusader Joanna before her. So the Crusaders, like, aren't, I think it's like 160 something of them. And they had like 200 originally, but some died and didn't get replacements. But that's how the order has existed. There's not that many of them. The Crusaders are very secret, very close-knit order that for a long time was just living in the swamps east of, oh, bloody heck. I'm trying to remember the name of the damn town. Not Karast. It's in Act 3. No, Act 2 of Diablo 3, and it's the one you go to in Diablo 2. The Emperor Hakan.
Oh, east of Chaldeum?
Chaldeum is the city in question. They're in the swamps to the far east of Chaldeum. That's where they started, and that's where they were for a very long time. And they didn't leave the swamps. They were, like, wandering around through the swamps, basically. It's the people from that area. The reason that, for instance, Joanna's got long blonde hair is because the people from that area are, like, blonde. That's where they've basically – they're very distant from their origins. And that's – paladins are – their study of the Zakharum faith, they were taught by, you know, people right there in places like Karast. They were very much a part of, like, knightly order with a rigid structure, and their teaching of the light comes from that. If you read the Book of Cain, the Book of Tyrael, you get, like, a good overview of exactly how it worked. Whereas the Hakan's Crusaders, you basically got taught by your mentor, who got taught by their mentor, who got taught by their mentor. And there's nobody else. There's no one else to teach you anything. So in a way, the only tricks that you pick up that aren't part of the original teaching are what you've learned in the field to pass on to your student when you get one. It's a very different focus and a different order. These are much more wandering knights errant. Paladins were part of an order that is part of the church and that was assigned to do stuff by the church. And now that the Zakharum faith has been through some really rough stuff, like it's very hard to come back from, oh, and by the way, one of the three Satan brothers has been running this place the whole time. But we're still worth praying to. You know, it's very hard for that to be overcome, and it doesn't feel like it has been. You're some 40 years in the future from Diablo 2 by the time you get to Diablo 4. And it doesn't feel like the church has recovered from it. There's even, like, when you play Diablo 3, there's that part when you go in and the guy's like, you know, the Zakharum has failed. What fate can save us? And he's a priest. He's a Zakharum priest in the town. And that's what he's saying. You know, that, like, these are some winning sermons, Father. Yeah, I'm feeling reassured now with your whole thing about how we're all going to die. Great job. So, yeah, the difference between the Paladins and Crusaders is basically one group was very much a part of the church, was effectively its military arm, like the Swiss Guard in the Vatican.
The veterans of the veterans.
Yeah, and one group was isolated. It was not part of the church. It was deliberately kept safe from the corruption that was in the church. But as a result, it didn't really have any real understanding of what was going on in the church. So when the church fell, they were still being Crusaders. They don't know any other way to be. You live your life in search of the truth. You may never find it, but you look for it, and you take a student and you teach that student. And when you die, that student becomes you, and does the same thing you were doing. So that's how they differ.
And this wasn't part of Drani's original question, but the difference between Paladins and Crusaders and Templars are that the Templars are basically an overzealous super cult that's ostensibly part of Zakharum, but really isn't.
Yeah.
And they're just a super extreme version of Paladins. That uses brainwashing and is basically just about, you know, one of the more evil paladin orders you can get from. And Cormac just happens to be an okay guy, turns out. So, yeah, that's Templars for you.
All right.
Very, very short explanation for Templar.
Which is unfortunate because the Templars have the best sounding Grandmaster in that they have this, you know, I love him as an actor. I think he's really great.
Right.
But that brings us all to our time limit today, since we ran a little bit long, but that's okay. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. Your continued support means this podcast, site, and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. Again, if you have any questions for the show, please make sure that you send them in to podcast@blizzardwatch.com. You can also, if you have any ideas for themed shows or if you want us to cover a topic in depth, send those in as well. You can also hit us up on Discord. We have a lovely channel set aside for podcast and queue questions for our Patreon supporters. I would like to thank Crow for taking the time out of his busy day to come and hang out with us and talk about Echo. And yeah, hopefully you have fun being here with us.
Always do, guys. Always do.
And with that, we will see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.